Hi, everybody. Today's Tuesday, July 29th, 2025, and Professor Mahdi is back after having some sort of technical problems, and it's all solved. I hope nothing would happen during this talk. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you, Nima. Sorry for the problem, but it's always a pleasure being with you.
I want to start, Professor Mahdi, with what has happened. We had the two interviews that the president of Iran had with Tucker Carlson, and we had the foreign minister of Iran talking on Fox News. And here is what, in the aftermath of these two, Donald Trump came out and said that Iran yesterday and the day before, he said that Iran has been very nasty with their words, because they're talking about the enrichment, by the way, he's talking about this. And they're still talking about enrichment after getting a beating. And who does that? We won't allow it. And on the other hand, we had the Iranian foreign minister answering or responding to what Donald Trump said. He says Iran knows what has happened during the fight between Iran and Israel, between Iran and Israel together with the United States. And they know what has happened on their part. And they have been trying, the United States together with Israel, is they were trying to censor what has happened to them. And if aggression is repeated, we will not hesitate to react in a more decisive manner and in a way that will be impossible to cover up. What's going on in the mind of Iranian government or the Iranian people? How do they feel about the way that Donald Trump is trying to, some, I don't know if we can call it, communicate with the government in Iran?
I don't think people in Iran take him very seriously at all. He's all over the place, and he says different things at different times. He is very insulting, very impolite. Remember, he threatened Ayatollah Khamenei once, threatened to murder him. And therefore, he has zero respect. He has about as much respect among Iranians as Jeffrey Epstein or Netanyahu. I think the Iranian foreign minister's tweet was quite good, and that he pointed out that next time around we'll hit much harder. And already in this 12-day war, as I've said before, it's quite clear that it was the Iranians who won the war. If Trump and Netanyahu felt that they were winning the war, then they would have continued with the aggression. There's no doubt about that. It's not as if the Americans and the Israelis and the Israeli regime want to have peace and stability in the region. If they had an advantage, they would have pressed that advantage. They would have pushed harder, but they were losing. And that's something that Steve Bannon himself pointed out when the cessation of hostilities began. When we had the cessation of hostilities, he said Trump basically saved the Israeli regime. He saved Netanyahu. Now, some have criticized the president for his interview with Tucker Carlson, and some have criticized the foreign minister for his interview with Fox. I think some of the criticisms are valid. They could have been better. But I think in general, the audience that the president and the foreign minister were seeking out was the American people and is the American people. Again, I think that they could have been more assertive, but they were speaking to an American audience, and they wanted to press the argument. They wanted to push the argument that this is the United States that's carrying out aggression. It is Trump that is betraying his supporters by starting new wars. Otherwise, the Iranians are, if there are any messages to be sent, they are sending them through the different channels to the Americans, and they are quite assertive. As we speak, the Iranians are preparing themselves for potential round two, especially since the Epstein issue is going to be very important in the coming weeks and months. And we know that presidents in the United States in the past, they start bombing countries when things start looking bad in order to divert attention away from their own problems. For example, in the case of Bill Clinton, when he bombed a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan and pretended that it was producing chemical weapons, that was to distract attention away from his problems that arose due to his illicit relationship in the White House. So the Iranians are preparing themselves, but I think it's been very clear from statements made by government officials that Iran will continue to enrich uranium and that Iran will preserve its high-tech capabilities and it will enhance its defense capabilities.
Yeah. We learned from CNN that the United States used up roughly a quarter of its THAAD missiles during the war, 12 days of war. And what does that mean? It means something like 100 to 150 missiles. When I remember the attack and an Iranian missile coming into the Israeli airspace, you see not one or two interceptors, more than nine interceptors going to hit the missile. You look at the numbers, you cannot believe that Israel could have continued the conflict, the war between the two parties. Do we know, we had an interview with an Iranian, the CEO of an Iranian drone factory. If I'm not mistaken, he did an interview on Al-Mayadeen. He said that Israelis, together with Americans, they were prepared for 3 days of conflict, 3 days of war, not beyond that. Do you think that was the case?
Yes, my understanding is that the Israeli regime and the Americans were planning for a short war, and that the Iranian government, the state, would collapse from within. And what you point out is, and I know your audience knows this, but we have to keep reminding ourselves that this is the entire U.S. stock that is used for the entire world. In other words, in East Asia, in Europe, all of these combined right now, all of these bases, all of U.S. Surface to air or THAAD missile capabilities, they are being severely undermined because they've been using their resources and their missiles to protect the Israeli regime. And simultaneously, the Israeli regime has been using everything that it has to defend itself against Iranian missiles and Iranian drones. And the Americans pay for those too. It's not as if the Israeli regime pays for its own weapons or for the wars that it carries out. The Holocaust in Gaza is being paid for by the Americans, the British, the Canadians, the French, the Germans. But of course, the Americans are paying the most. The slaughter in Syria, the slaughter in Lebanon, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, all of this is funded by the United States. So the United States is paying a heavy price for defending the Israeli regime. And from my understanding, during the last 3-4 days, the Israelis were unable to intercept Iranian missiles. Almost all Iranian missiles got through since day eight. Maybe one or two were intercepted, but as far as I know, at least 90% got through. And that shows that the regime no longer had the capability to protect itself, and that the Iranians had yet to use its advanced missiles in large numbers. We have to remind ourselves that the Iranians were, throughout this war, using overwhelmingly older missiles and older drones. So the Israelis and Americans were using the best that they had, and the Iranians were using what they had in stock, except for on rare occasions where they really wanted to punish the regime and hit someplace very hard.
Professor, do you feel that you've mentioned that Iran is expecting a new round of attacks from Israel? What do, when it comes to the final objective, we know that they wanted to do regime change or so-called regime change in Iran. But what is in it for the Trump administration? If are they going to give the green light to the Israelis to attack Iran again?
Well, we'll have to see. The assumption in Iran is that there will be another attack. And I think that's a sound assumption. Iran has to prepare itself for whether it believes that there's a very high probability or a low probability possibility. The Iranians have to prepare themselves. But it's, I think, Trump being the unpredictable person that he is, it's quite possible. We saw how he's just hours ago, he shifted his position on Russia. Now he's speaking about secondary sanctions or possibly secondary sanctions in 10 to 12 days, which is, you know, it just shows that the decision-making process in the United States, especially since Trump returned to power, has no, there's no structure behind the decision-making process. It's just everything, anything can happen. Trump is completely unpredictable.
Yeah.
And that makes the United States both less trustworthy by in the eyes of its own allies, and people take anything that he says less seriously. He may launch a war, but then again, he may not. So people start ignoring what he says because he's changing all the time. But there is, you know, for example, if Trump in 12 days, there is no ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine, and of course there won't be a ceasefire. The Russians are winning the war. And it's coming to, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the collapse of the Ukrainian regime. So, and maybe that's the reason why Trump changed his policies. That's one interpretation. Maybe things are even worse than we think, and that he's shortening this period of time in order to give the Ukrainians more help to stop the Russians from overwhelming them. Who knows? But the point is that if Trump implements his threats, for example, if he carries out secondary sanctions, that means he'll be targeting China, India, among others, and that is going to further isolate the United States. So it doesn't seem like much thought is being put into the decision-making process in the White House. And the same is true with Iran. So Trump may give Netanyahu a green light, and then again, he may not. But it's not as if we can predict based upon an understanding of Trump's logic. There is no logic back there for us to predict him using that logic or that past. So again, I think that the possibility is quite high because Trump continues to support Netanyahu. In Scotland, Trump for the first time acknowledged that there's starvation taking place in Gaza. Is he doing anything to stop the starvation? No. And he's actually demanding the rest of the world thank him for supposedly putting some money into goods to take into Gaza, whereas he knows that nothing is getting in. So when you have such a person who has no respect for human life, who is carrying out a Holocaust, he is a war criminal. He is just as evil as is Netanyahu. They're partners in all this. So it is quite possible that Trump will allow Netanyahu to carry out an attack, and Netanyahu needs war to remain in power. He needs instability, unrest, because he has problems, as we all know. He has legal problems. So it's impossible at this stage to figure out what will happen. But what is clear is that And we've been discussing this for a very long time. The world has turned against the Israeli regime. But now it's becoming so bad that the people who are actually a part of this Holocaust, like the British Prime Minister, like the French president, they are all partners in this Holocaust. They've been all slaughtering the people of Palestine together alongside Netanyahu. Now, suddenly, they've changed their language. They haven't changed their policies, but they've changed their language. You see Clinton or Obama, who gave probably the most ridiculous tweet of them all, but all of them are shifting away from their previous position because it's getting very bad. And I think that as we go further, now that everyone is turning against the regime, the Western media has suddenly they've turned against the regime. Not that they are against the Holocaust; it's just because it's become so ugly that they are trying to protect themselves, just like these senior officials. So it's unclear how much longer Netanyahu can continue with this Holocaust without causing instability. We're already seeing signs of unrest in some Arab countries. And we're seeing people increasingly outraged in the region. And so, you know, instead of looking to see what will happen in the West and in Western capitals, I'm sort of wondering what may happen in our region. We have to remember, Nima, that when that young man burned himself alive in Tunisia, he created upheaval across North Africa and West Asia. The situation today is much more explosive. And I think that the United States and the Israeli regime and their allies are not taking this element as important enough as it should be in their calculations.
We had a report on the Defense Security Asia. Here is the outlet reported that Iran reportedly conducts first ever operational test of Russian S-400 air defense systems near Isfahan. Do you have any information on that? And because apart from that, and considering that, what is the main strategy of Iran? You mentioned that Iran feels that they're going to attack Iran. And how is that going to play out in the mind of Iranians in terms of the air defense system, in terms of the cooperation with Russia and China? Many people are asking what would happen to Iran in the near future or in a long run.
Well, I have to first raise a couple of issues or put forward a couple of issues because I think they're important for your audience. One is that there was a myth that was spread online that the Iranians did not want Russian air defenses or cooperation with Russia in the past. That's not true. The Iranians have been working with the Russians, with the Chinese. The Iranians have their own air defense systems. And there was never an offer by the Russians to have them have some sort of protective umbrella over Iran. Iran is a sovereign country. Russia is a sovereign country. The two countries work together. Iran purchases military hardware. So do the Russians from the Iranians. The same is true with China. Russia's ability to export certain items is limited because it's engaged in an all-out war. And we know that the drone and missile strikes against Russia have been quite extensive, especially the recent drone strikes. And some believe that in the coming weeks, there are going to be longer range missile striking Russia as well. So the Russians have some capabilities to help that they can export to Iran. And I'm sure that the Iranians will purchase whatever they feel necessary and whatever the Russians have to offer. I don't know about details, but But what I do know is that the Iranians are beefing up their air defense systems. Iran has its own air defense systems, its own radar systems that they make locally. Those have been those were deployed, and they had successes. So the Iranians are going to expand on developing their own indigenous production. And also there's the Chinese as well. The Chinese and the Russians both recognize, just as Iran recognizes, that U.S. success against Russia is bad news, U.S. success against China is bad news because of the nature of the empire. The same is true with the Chinese and the Russians. So Iran will cooperate and continue to cooperate with these countries. Another thing, on a very unrelated note, Nima, is because some of these things come online, and that is with regards to the Zangezur, so-called Zangezur corridor, that some people have said that Iran's policy has changed. That's just not true. The Iranians have made it known to Aliyev, who is, of course, an ally of Netanyahu. They've made it known to the Armenian government, and they've made it known to Mr. Erdogan and the Russians that Iran will not allow the southern part of Armenia to be taken away from Armenia, or its sovereignty to be taken away from the country. Iran will not allow its access to Armenia, or through Armenia to Jordan, or through Jordan to Russia and the Black Sea, to be impeded by anyone. And that basically means that if the Iranians have to use force, they will do that. And Iran has deployed large numbers of troops on the border to send that signal. So Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Aliyev, in their cooperation with the Israeli regime, during the 12-day war, they were betting on the wrong horse. They thought that the Israeli regime will come out on top. And they've been making more noise about this corridor. Well, the Israeli regime lost the war. If the war resumes, Iran will hit back much harder next time around. Iran is restructuring and rebuilding its capabilities and developing new capabilities as we speak. The Israeli regime has used all of its capabilities, but Iran hasn't. So this assessment by Aliyev and perhaps Erdogan has turned out to be false. And therefore, so the point I'm trying to make is, some of the things that I've been hearing from some of your viewers and others who are interested in regional politics or who are experts on regional politics, their assessments are incorrect. Iran's policy has not changed. Iran's engagement with Russia has not changed. Iran has always been cooperating with the Russians, and the Russians with Iran. But the Russians have had limitations in the past. But the issue of Iran's national security is very important for Russia. It is very important for China, just as Russian national security and Chinese national security are very important for Iran, because the United States is targeting all three of these countries. And if the United States has success anywhere, it will encourage, that success will encourage Trump to be more aggressive on other fronts.
You mentioned the Zangezur corridor. We know that it's in the southern part of, between Azerbaijan and Armenia, in the southern part of Armenia. How is that going? Do you feel that they're going to give it to Azerbaijan? Then Azerbaijan going to let the United States somehow, because there were rumors the United States wants to rent this corridor. How are these rumors just, or there is something going on in that region?
Well, the Armenian government has told Iran that this is not true. But the Iranians have said very clearly that if it does turn out to be true, it won't be tolerated. And that basically means that Iran will be willing to go to war. And if there is war, there is no doubt that the Aliyev regime will not last long, and that the Zangezur corridor will never exist. That the Iranians, if they feel they have to occupy it, they will occupy it. They will make sure that Armenian sovereignty is preserved, just like Iran supported the sovereignty of the Republic of Azerbaijan when Armenia had the upper hand. And this is something that your viewers don't know. And there is footage of this. I actually tweeted this during the war 4 or 5 years ago, when the Republic of Azerbaijan was attacking Armenia. When the Armenian government attacked Azerbaijan and took its territory, which, whether we like it or not, based on international law, belonged to the Republic of Azerbaijan, Iran opposed this, and Iran trained Azeri troops in order that they retake their territory. Then the Americans put pressure on Aliyev to stop the Iranians from helping train troops, and they expelled the Iranians. This was 3 decades ago. Now more than 3 decades ago. So Iran supported Azerbaijan's sovereignty back then. It actually helped train them to retake the territory, and that territory would have probably been regained decades ago if Aliyev had not obeyed the United States. But now Iran is saying, we will not allow Armenian sovereignty to be undermined. So this thin piece of territory that links Iran through Armenia to Georgia and the Black Sea and Russia, Iran under no circumstances will allow anyone to take that away from the control of the government of Armenia. Now, if there is a road that passes through Armenia and the Armenians control it, that's none of Iran's business. Iraq can have a link from the Persian Gulf to Turkey without using Iranian territory. The airplanes can fly around Iran and not use commercial airplanes. They can fly around Iran and go over Iraq or over the Caspian Sea without using Iranian airspace. That's not Iran's business. But Iran will not allow its access to be impeded by a third country, whether it's the Americans or Aliyev or anyone else. That's not going to happen. And the Iranians have been very clear about this.
Are there communications between Iran and Russia vis-a-vis the corridor, the Zangezur corridor? Because how does Russia perceive that? How does Russia see what's going on? Is that the same sort of position as Iran is taking?
Well, Iran has its own problems with the Republic of Aliyev right now, as we all know, and it has been said that the Russians have bombed refineries in Ukraine that were using oil from the Republic of Azerbaijan, and thus sending a message to Aliyev, because apparently those who ran the refineries were his people. I don't know the details. I don't know how true this is, but that's something that has been said. But in any case, there are tensions. But Iran does not want to have any instability in the Caucasus. Iran does not want to have any instability in the Persian Gulf region. And Iran does not want to have any instability with any of its neighbors. But the point is that Iran will not tolerate anyone undermining the sovereignty of Armenia. And Iran will not allow its path through Armenia to be controlled by any government except for the Armenian government.
We know that the north-south corridor comes from Russia to Azerbaijan, passes through Azerbaijan and goes to Iran. And how is that going to play out with the current phase of the conflicts? Azerbaijan somehow behaving toward Iran, and Russia, you see some sort of conflict growing in the region. And the bigger project that we were talking about and how the importance of this project for Russia and Iran and passing through Azerbaijan and with the instability that we're witnessing in Azerbaijan, how is that going to play out? How is that going to be perceived by Iran and Russia?
Well, Iran and Russia together, if they want this corridor, then I don't think that that's going to be stopped. And it also, it's not just, it doesn't just pass through the Republic of Azerbaijan. It also goes through the Caspian Sea, and it goes across from alongside the eastern coast of the Caspian Sea through Turkmenistan into Iran as well. So it is not just one particular route. It's multiple routes. And in addition to that, there is potential to have a further trade carried out through Armenia and Georgia. But that area is mountainous, and there are difficulties, and it's expensive. But for the time being, this is what the north-south corridor is supposed to be. And the Republic of Azerbaijan is not a person. There is a, you know, Aliyev is in charge. He's an ally of the Israeli regime. But ultimately, I think as the United States loses its war in Ukraine, its proxy war in Ukraine, and after the 12-day war that we saw where the Israeli regime attacked Iran, I think that the Republic of Azerbaijan's government will gradually begin to recognize that it's best to have good relations with your real neighbors rather than those who are willing to use, who want to use you as tools for their benefit. What the Israeli regime wants is to sacrifice Azerbaijan for its own selfish interests. It's the same is true with the United States. It's a pawn on the chessboard for the United States. And the smart thing, of course, would be for Aliyev to recognize this and distance himself away from NATO and the NATO projects that we have in the region. And of course, I see President Erdogan as a part of NATO. He's not, Erdogan, what he's done during the last 22 months has been completely in alignment with the United States, whether in Ukraine, whether with the Israeli regime. He's only done harm to the resistance, and I think he's been trying to take advantage of the war instead of helping the Palestinians, but using the Israeli regime's war against the resistance to weaken the resistance for himself in order to create a sort of mini Ottoman Empire in Syria, parts of Lebanon, Iraq, and the Caucasus. But that's not going to work. And ultimately, Erdogan has destroyed his own image and credibility, except for those who willfully keep their eyes closed, because he's done nothing for the Palestinian people. As they starve, as we speak, and Palestinians are starving, he continues to transport Aliyev's oil to the Israeli regime. And some people say, well, he has to do so. The decision is made in Baku. Aliyev if Erdogan told him to stop exporting to Palestine, have no doubt that he would do that.
Professor Marandi, we know that Azerbaijan was somehow manipulated to go against Iran and Russia. But how about Armenia? How do you see the situation in Armenia? Is Armenia growing to be a new Azerbaijan in the region? That would be hugely problematic for Iran and Russia. That would be hugely challenging.
Well, I think Erdogan was telling the Armenians, and so were the Americans and others, during the 12-day war, that Iran is losing and that you're going to have to listen to us. And their calculations turned out to be wrong. And the Iranians spoke to the Armenian leadership and the prime minister and other officials, and they've said that, no, we're not going to give up our sovereignty. Of course, hypothetically, if the Armenians were to do so, regardless of the fact that the Iranians will make sure that that doesn't happen by any means necessary, But if they were so, that, to do so, that would mean the end of Armenia, because Armenia would only have three borders, one with Turkey, one with Aliyev, and then one with Georgia, which in Georgia has its own problems and its own loyalties and its own internal dynamics, makes it an unreliable partner. And then, of course, there would be whoever controls the Zangezur corridor. That would mean the end of Armenia. And so I don't think that that's going to, I don't think that the government in Armenia would make such a decision. But it was under pressure because it was being told during, at the beginning of the 12-day war, that look, Iran is finished. And it turned out to be the exact opposite.
Do you feel that the Arab states in the region, what would be the take on their part? What would be the policy on their part in the aftermath of the war between Iran and Israel? Are they somehow changing their mind toward Iran? Do they feel that if something happens to Iran, they're going to be next? Because it's so important to understand their sort of mindset.
They are very worried, not just, I mean, this goes, you know, this is not because of the end result of the war, but because of the nature of the Israeli regime. Remember, the Israeli regime had very good relations with Ashara. And Netanyahu, he was having dialogue with him through Erdogan. So Erdogan, instead of helping the Palestinian people, he was trying to bring about reconciliation between Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Israeli regime, the government, the Al-Qaeda government. And so we were told that they had negotiations along the border and in other places, and including in Baku, in the Republic of Azerbaijan, but that there was a misunderstanding. No one believes that there was a misunderstanding. How can there be? It wasn't as if the Israeli officials or an Israeli official met an Al-Qaeda official at some street corner, said a couple of sentences and moved on, and then that was misunderstood. These were detailed negotiations that had taken place in multiple countries, and each time multiple rounds, and all of them had delegations and everything was written. There's no misunderstanding. So, and Ashara or Jolani had been sending all sorts of messages to the Israelis. We all know that he kept saying that our enemies are the same, Iran and Hezbollah. So he kissed the ring. And then when he moved troops to the south to destroy the forces that were not obeying him, the Druze groups and the different political entities in the Druze-controlled areas, the Israelis bombed him. That's not a misunderstanding. The Israelis allowed him to come in, and the plan was to bomb them. I have no doubt about that. It's the sort of misunderstanding that, if you recall, when Saddam Hussein met the American ambassador and spoke about taking Kuwait, the American ambassador spoke in a way which was interpreted as a green light. Well, you know, that even that is questionable, whether it was intentional or not, the way in which she spoke, the American ambassador at the time. But this is very different from that. This is not a meeting of one-on-one meeting with the ambassador and the president. These two sides have been negotiating in detail about the Golan Heights and the occupation and the south. So this is something that these Arab countries are now worried about, because they're saying it doesn't matter if you're resistance like Hezbollah or Ansarullah, or you're Iran, or whether you are a pathetic proxy of Erdogan in Syria who's trying to kiss the ring of Netanyahu. You will still get hammered if that's what Netanyahu wills. And that sends a very a dangerous message. And that is something that the Saudis are worried about. That is something that the Jordanians are worried about. That's something that Egypt is worried about. So this continued genocidal war and the attacks on sovereign countries by the Israeli regime, what it did in Syria, has created fear across the region. And that has been provided an opportunity for Iran to communicate with these countries and to discuss improving relations. So it's, I think it hasn't gone well for the regime. And the fact that the Iranians won the war, I think that's acknowledged across the region. That no one is going to brag about it in these countries for obvious reasons, but they do recognize that the Iranians did come out on top. So there's this fear of this recklessness of Netanyahu and this unpredictability of Trump and the fact that Trump greenlights everything and everything that Netanyahu does. But at the same time, there's this recognition that there is a counterforce as well. And the recklessness of Trump is something that, you know, goes beyond the region. The fact that, you know, like an American general spoke about taking Kaliningrad, you know, Russian territory, which could bring in, you know, nuclear war, but no one punished him. He was not removed from his position. It just shows how Washington, you know, has lost its mind, and that the White House, there's no policy, there's no stability, there's no foundation upon which you can their policies are founded upon, so that you can predict what they're going to do tomorrow, how they're going to behave tomorrow. And that is not, I would assume, that too adds to the sense of concern that exists across West Asia and North Africa. Because if the, you know, U.S. general can be so reckless about policy towards Russia and war against Russia and Russian territory, then you can imagine what sort of things can be done on the, you know, around in and around Palestine.
Does the U.S. foreign policy differ from the Israeli one when it comes to al-Jolani or al-Shara?
No, I mean, there may be differing opinions, but at the end of the day, if the Israelis push for a particular policy, the Americans are not going to do anything about it. So you may have a differing view in Washington, but ultimately it's going to be Netanyahu's choice to make. Whether it's if the Americans have differences with the regime over the West Bank or some of the ethnic cleansing that's being carried out there, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, no matter what Netanyahu does, he'll have support from Washington. And this is not unique to Trump. This was true about Biden as well. When we were hearing about tensions between Biden and Netanyahu and how Biden was trying to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the Holocaust in Gaza, later it came out that was all not true. It was just false. It was a lie. So U.S. policy in West Asia and North Africa is held hostage, and it's been that way for a very, very long time. It's gone worse over the last 2-3 decades, and that's why the Israeli regime is a liability, has always been a liability to the United States, at least since I've been an adult, because it's only caused hatred and anger towards the United States to increase, and now for the last 22 months, it's gone through the roof, not just the United States, the entire West, and not just in our region, but across the world and inside the West itself. This whole Epstein affair, Nima, is disgusting. And of course, the Mossad roots and the Israeli roots in this affair is disgusting as well. And Americans are disgusted. But the fact that this is the same Mossad and the same Israeli regime that is, for the last 22 months, been carrying out a Holocaust in Gaza, raping prisoners, pulling the plug from incubators to murder infants, targeting children for pleasure, one day hitting them in the head, a second day in other sensitive parts of their bodies. All these outrageous things that even the Nazis wouldn't propagate, the way that no one has in the past propagated their crimes like the Israeli regime does, and does it in front of the eyes of the world. This, alongside this 22 months, now Israel and the Mossad and the regime are seen as this genocidal entity that is also using girls as tools of rape to gain influence among donors, among politicians. This has made it much worse for the regime. So the United States, its alliance with the Israeli regime is a liability. Saying it's a liability is an understatement. It has destroyed its image across the world. It's destroyed the image of Europe across the world. And it's destroyed the image of the regime in Washington and the regime in London and Paris and Berlin and elsewhere. Among their own people.
It seems that the Trump administration is somehow trapped in the middle of between Turkey and Israel. Turkey is pushing for support for al-Jolani, and on the other hand, Israel doesn't want him to be in power. How is that? Do you think that Turkey is gaining some sort of leverage on the decisions that the Trump administration is making toward Syria?
No, not at all. Erdogan has no status compared to Netanyahu in Washington. And for him to even dream of that, I think is going too far. He has put all his eggs in the wrong basket, and he will be remembered. Someone who helped enable the Holocaust in Gaza and enabled the Israeli regime to carry out all these wars. And he tried to use these wars to gain credibility in the West and to expand his influence in the Caucasus and in Iraq and Syria. And he's only done damage to our region. Israel will remember the role that Erdogan and his proxies have played, especially. Not Jolani, it's just a small pawn. Ultimately, Jolani they'll take him out and they'll replace him with someone else at some point. But even that's not going to work. In this region, there's only one important actor for the Americans and the Europeans, and that is the Israeli regime. That is Netanyahu. Remember, just a few days ago, the Europeans sanctioned a number of Iranians, I don't know, for human rights or something. I read somewhere in the Iranian media. The Europeans and Americans are not sanctioning anyone in the Israeli government. They're not putting any sanctions on the regime. It's business as usual and aid as usual. And intelligence gathering for the Israeli regime as usual by the British, by the Germans, by across Europe. They will continue to support the Holocaust until every Palestinian is killed, until all the children have been exterminated. That's the influence. No one should believe that there's just one Epstein. There are many Epsteins. And I think those pro-Palestinian activists, whether politicians or otherwise, should be very careful when they're approached by young people or certain people. But I'm sure there are many Epsteins. And it's not just sex, it's also bribes, it's other forms of the intelligence that they gather from people, finding weaknesses that they may have to control politicians and the decision-making process across European countries and in North America. And they are ruthless. I mean, look at how even Europe is being treated by the United States now. Look at the trade deal between the EU and the United States. The United States is ruthless to its own allies, to Japan. I mean, why in the world would the United States give a country like led by Erdogan, a certain status that would be frowned upon by their close ally in Tel Aviv. That's just unthinkable.
You mentioned the European countries. We know that France has decided, at least they're talking about it, they want to recognize the state of Palestine in September. And looking at Europe and the policy of Europe in Gaza, in Palestine, what can we learn from their new sort of attitude if they decide, if I would put an if, because we don't know if, we know Macron is somehow, it's unbelievable, we cannot trust him. He changes his mind each and every day. And that's why I don't believe that we can rely on what he's talking about. But after all, do you see that with the videos, with the photos coming out of Gaza, we know the suffering that is going on in Gaza. Is that going to change, at least to save their faces? There's somehow the government, the way that they go, because they want to show themselves and to the public opinion of their countries that they want to care about Gaza. They care about Gaza. Is that going to happen? Is that going to bring some sort of changes, some sort of even teeny tiny changes to what's going on in Gaza?
Well, we saw after the French president spoke about recognizing Palestine, how Trump slapped him, sort of like the way in which his wife or husband slapped him when he was exiting the plane a while back. We don't know if it's a husband or a wife, but anyway, he was slapped down. And in any case, even if France does recognize Palestine, it will, and we don't know, as you rightly pointed out, we don't know if Macron will ultimately do that. But it's not going to have any impact. And I don't think the impact, he intends it to have an impact. The Israeli regime is colonizing the West Bank and ethnically cleansing the West Bank in ways which it has never done before. And it's, no one is doing anything about it. And European diplomats in Tel Aviv and in Palestine, they're pretending that's nothing happening. You can look at their Twitter accounts and it's all fun and games for them. And they're enjoying their meetings with their genocidal counterparts in Israel. And there, it's as if nothing's happening in the broader world for these diplomats who, you know, they're all guilty as sin. They're all a part of this Holocaust. In an ideal world, they'd all be put on trial just like after the Second World War. And so would Trump and so would all these other people. But in any case, it's not going to have any real impact whether he states the recognition of Palestine or not. He's not going to do anything important. There's no sanctions going to be imposed on the Israeli regime, and aid to the Israeli regime will continue regardless. And Europe is feeble and weak. Not only did we see that in this ridiculous trade deal, which is, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out, but so far it was a humiliation for the Europeans. But, you know, 3.5 years ago, I think it was, when I was with the Iranian nuclear negotiators in Vienna, I was telling these Europeans and their elites, those, you know, who I'd meet on a daily basis, that, look, you're in trouble. You have a war with Russia and Ukraine now. You're imposing sanctions, so you're not going to be using Russian fuel, or you're going to try to stop using Russian fuel, oil and gas. And you're dependent on the United States, and the United States, they are the natural gas coming from there is very expensive. If you strike a deal with Iran, you will be able to alleviate your problems. And you can purchase Iranian oil and gas, and you can invest in Iran's gas sector, and over time, well, it's been almost 4 years now. It's been 3.5 years almost. And of course, back then, the Europeans did not have the will to take the last step. The Americans, when there was a tax, ultimately Biden balked. He backed off. He didn't sign the agreement. And the Europeans did nothing about it. Why? Because they're passive and they obey Washington. So now the Europeans, they have no access to Iranian oil and gas. They have no access to Russian oil and gas. They are now going to be fully dependent on expensive American gas. They're the big losers. And they're, of course, engaging in a war with Ukraine, where we're told that they're going to have to pay for the weapons that the United States sells. That doesn't look very good for the future of Europe. The deindustrialization that we're hearing about and people are explaining is taking place as we speak in Germany and in other parts of Europe, that is just going to continue, and Europe is going to become increasingly unimportant. So the U.S. ally is not a U.S. ally. The United States is destroying Europe. It's wrecking Europe. It doesn't care about Europe. And Trump only cares about himself. So it's this is the state of play. And therefore, I don't see, in this respect, I actually agree with Trump. God forgive me. But when he says France is not important, Macron is not important, he's not important.
We had a meeting or some sort of talks between France and Saudi Arabia. They're talking about two-state solution. How can they talk about two-state solution? There is no land in the hand of Palestinians. They're getting, Israelis are capturing the West Bank, and I don't know, they're talking about Gaza. How is that going to be a possible solution in your opinion?
It's not a solution. They know it's not a solution. 10 years ago, it wasn't a solution. 15 years ago, it wasn't a solution. It was never a solution. That was all a show. It was order. It was done in order to keep people quiet and to give the Israeli regime time to take over the West Bank. The colonization of the West Bank began a very long time ago. And the people that are colonizing the West Bank are the worst of the worst. They are the worst forms of Zionists. These people are never going to leave willingly. And that was the intention all along. And now there are roughly, I think, 800,000 of them. The Europeans and Americans knew this all along. They are diplomats in Tel Aviv and now some in Al-Quds or Jerusalem. They know this, but they pretend not to see it. They talk about the two-state solution, not because they believe it's ever going to happen, but because that's the way to say that we are humane. That's the way to present themselves as decent people. But in fact, it's the opposite. They're deceitful people. They're dishonest people. They're providing a cover for the Israeli regime, but at the same time, they're providing cover for themselves in order to deflect anger away from themselves. When people are outraged, they say, well, we're working on the two-state solution. So it's not serious. And anyone who's pursuing the notion of a two-state solution is in reality supporting the Israeli regime, but also trying to protect themselves. Just like the tweets and the comments made over the last few days by Hillary Clinton and Obama and Starmer and others, they've all been supporting this Holocaust, this genocide. They either through their silence or as officials through their active support. Starmer himself actually said that once upon a time that the Israelis have the right to cut off electricity and food supplies and all that. They're just now trying to protect themselves and say we're against this. But at the same time, they're not imposing any sanctions. They're not halting their assistance. So they're still a part of this. And this whole two-state solution facade is the same thing. It's designed to help the Israeli regime, but at the same time, it's designed to protect the people who are speaking about a two-state solution. By the way, a two-state solution is sinister and evil in itself, even if, hypothetically, magically, we have two states. And magically, the Zionists leave the West Bank. What about the rest of Palestine? Basically, what they're saying is that a ethno-supremacist regime that believes that everyone else is subhuman they control this territory and everything is fine. Morally, it is unacceptable. And in practice, we're seeing a Nazi regime, a regime that's worse than the Nazi regime. They're doing it in front of the eyes of the world. And they are very open about it. So the two-state solution is just a facade. It's immoral. And it's a ploy to keep people quiet and to preserve their credibility and also to allow give the Israeli regime cover to carry on with their colonization and ethnic cleansing and mass murder.
Yeah. Professor Morandi, Steve Witkoff went to talk. He talked with, I don't know, directly or indirectly with Hamas, and he said he cannot achieve any sort of agreement with them. What does he want from Hamas that the United States couldn't achieve that?
Capitulation. He's a Zionist. He is a Zionist. I mean, it's not just the fact that he's controlled by Zionists. He is a Zionist. So he's trying to take the burden off the shoulders of Netanyahu. Because if he could have just said nothing and let Netanyahu say that this is unacceptable. But he's the Israeli... he's the lawyer for the Israelis. Just like under Biden, it was the same thing. The Secretary of State back then, he was an Israeli, he was the lawyer for the Israelis. If you, every time that there was a ceasefire, remember when the resistance and Hamas accepted the ceasefire conditions put forward by the Biden regime, Netanyahu opposed them, and then the Secretary of State of the United States back then was saying Hamas is not accepting it and the Israelis accept it. The Americans kept saying that, even though Hamas accepted it. And the Israelis said no, they kept saying the opposite. Why? Because they're out to protect their genocidal allies. They're all in this together. No one should be fooled. This the regime in Washington is carrying out a Holocaust in Palestine. The EU is a partner in this Holocaust. The British, the Canadians, the Australians, New Zealand, all of them are partners in this Holocaust. And many of the regimes in our region are complicit in this Holocaust by doing business and trade, by having direct flights, by having embassies. They're all complicit. I mean, if we put aside the facade, and we're blunt and honest about it. This is a Holocaust where the driving force behind it has for the last 22 months been the White House.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor Morandi, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you, Nima. Always a pleasure, always an honor. See you hopefully soon.
See you soon.